All right, so if you will turn with me, if you got your scriptures handy, to the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, chapter 11. We're towards the end of chapter 11. And the parsha is called Re'eh, because that's how it begins. Of course, it says, "Behold, Re'eh, Anki, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse." Now, this is a theme that appears especially in Deuteronomy. It's one of my favorite references. It's literally one of the very essences of Torah. A choice. You have a choice. Blessing and curse. Life or death. And here it is. The blessing, he says, if... And notice that the word here is interesting. Now, this is a Rashiism, and I'm going to spend a minute or two on it because it's important. But the English says the following. It says, "The blessing, if you shall hearken unto the commandments of Yahuwah your God, Eloheka, which I command you today, and this curse, if you shall not hearken, Shamar, hear and obey the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka, but instead you turn aside out of the way that I command you and go after other so-called Elohim, other so-called mighty ones, other fake gods which you have not known." So literally, blessing and curse, pick. Follow Elohim, keep his word, his commandments, or follow after other gods. No. Okay. Where I want to spend a minute or two here, and get back on track. I had a question locally, and sorry, it messes up my train of thought. But the blessing, it says in the Hebrew there, sometimes the word that you see that is used for if is im, and sometimes it's not. And what Rashi points out in this case is the word actually is that. So it's let me read it a little different way and see if this makes more sense. Because we tend to think in the English, it doesn't really matter, right? The blessing if you hearken, or how about try it this way? The blessing that you will hearken unto the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka, which I command you. Well, I don't understand. Mark, what the heck does, what's the difference? The difference has to do with when the blessings happen. And again, this is Rashi's point. In other words, it's a blessing on condition that you do something up front. And I give the same example every time we go through this. Maybe I should come up with a better one. This is a pretty good example. I could say, if you fix my car, I'll pay you $100 to a mechanic. Or I could say it a little bit differently. I'll pay you $100 that you would fix my car. Well, in any case, you pay the $100, the car's going to get fixed. But the difference literally has to do with who trusts who and when the payment is made, right? If I trust the mechanic, I'll say, I'll give you $100 that you will fix my car. You pay him the $100, you go away knowing that he will fix the car. He gets the money up front. The other one is, well, I'll pay you $100 after, if you succeed in fixing my car. You don't get nothing until then. And the key point here is, this is the Creator that is basically saying to us, I'll give you the blessing up front. I'll give you the blessing that you keep my commandments. And that really is a truly wonderful and amazing thing. The blessing comes first. It's im, however, if you will not hearken, then the curse comes. But the curse comes after the fact. So somehow or other, I think that's a really important, yeah, it's a subtle difference, but it shows you kind of the, well, some would say the grace of the Creator, the idea that He is willing to bless us up front, and all we got to do is, well, I guess I like the way Yeshua put it, if you love me, keep my commandments. All the good stuff happens first. All we have to do, what is our reasonable service, is walk in obedience to Him. Then it says this, verse 29, it'll come to pass that when Yahuwah Eloheka brings you into the land that you go to possess, you will set up a blessing on Mount Gerizim and a curse upon Mount Ebal. So literally you got two mountains here, a blessing on the one hand, a curse on the other hand. And we're going to see this, this reference appears more than once in Scripture too. There are they not beyond the Jordan, beyond the way of the going down of the sun and the land of the Canaanites that dwell over Arabah against Gilgal beside the terebinth trees of Moreh? Well, you are going to pass over the Jordan, go into the land which Yahuwah gives you, and you will. You shall possess it and dwell therein. And here's the kicker. You shall observe to do, there's that word again, shamar, all of the statutes and the ordinances. No, it's not the law, but these are literally statutes, ordinances. These are commandments. Hukim, mishpatim, mitzvot, things that I command you this day. And then he says it again. Now, chapter 12 is one I'm probably going to spend the most time on this evening. And 13 too. I think these are extremely important and, of course, particularly overlooked by much of ex-Christianity because it's all Old Testament stuff, right? It's done away with. Doesn't matter anymore. And I've got an observation I'm going to throw out, but I think the way to get there best is to start into chapter 12 and then pause for a second and throw this out. It says this, here, these are the statutes and the ordinances which you shall observe to do now in the land which Yahuwah has given you to possess all the days that you live upon the earth. And then the first one that gets mentioned here is, it would seem he really, really, really hates these fake gods and their altars and their idols and all of the ways that they do what it is that they do in their paganism. You will surely, utterly destroy Abed. Literally, the word is repeated. There's an emphasis there. It's the PL conjugation, too, which is not just, you know, break, but smash to smithereens. I've mentioned that kind of interesting distinction in the language before. The verbs that are used in these next couple of verses are very much action verbs. Let me just read it and listen to it. You will surely, utterly destroy all these places where the nations that you're fixing to dispossess served their so-called gods up on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every leafy green tree. And you shall overthrow, break down, tear down their altars, dash in pieces their pillars, burn their asherim with fire, and hew down the graven images of their so-called gods. And you shall destroy their very name out of that place. So what you get here is a bunch of really graphic action words. Exterminate, blot out, do away with, break down, burn, dash in pieces. You kind of get the impression, right? He does not like this, and he says in the next verse, you're not going to do anything like this. You shall not do so unto Yahuwah Eloheka. But here's the contrast. There's a place that he is going to put his name. He's chosen to put his name there, and his habitation you will seek, and it's there that you'll come and to bring your burnt offerings and your tithes and your sacrifices and your free will offerings and your vows and the firstlings of your herd and of your flock. There is the place you shall eat before Yahuwah. And now this is another one of these interesting words. You shall rejoice in all that you put your hand to, you and your house, all these things that he has blessed you with. Don't do what we've been seeing up until this point. And by the way, we do see it later. Every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. You've not yet come to the rest and to the inheritance which you're being given. But when you go over the Jordan and dwell in the land, you're going to rest from your enemies. You'll dwell in safety. And it'll come to pass that that is when he will pick this place, put his name there. We know that that's going to be the place at which later, in the time of King David and more particularly his son Solomon, the temple will be built. And then it says this again, you will rejoice before Yahuwah, you, your sons, your daughters, your maidservants, your manservants, Levites within your gates, basically all of these folks in this place where he chooses to put his name. Now, I want to pause. Because there's an interesting set of contrasts here. First, we'll talk about the things that are clear. A, he hates these fake gods. Don't do anything like what the people in the land that are fixing to get dispossessed. Hey, have you noticed maybe there's a correlation? Don't do anything the way they do with their so-called gods. And furthermore, to make the distinction clear, there's going to be a place where I put my name. That's where you're going to go and bring all of your tithes and offerings and so forth. No foreign gods, in other words. Now, maybe in this case I won't mention the name because I frequently look at a whole bunch of Midrashim. As you know, there are several of my favorites, people that I read every week. And it's a good bet that it's one of those. But essentially, I took some issue with the way it was phrased this week in one of those teachings. The word is avodah zarah. That's what you're not supposed to have. That's basically foreign gods. No avodah zarah. And the question was asked by the fellow that was doing this particular teaching, hey, you know, we look at this and we don't get it, right? What's the deal with these foreign gods? How could they possibly have been so attractive to people then? What's the point of you know, wanting to offer a pagan sacrifice, lifting up your children to Molech? We don't do that, do we? In other words, said this particular opinion, all of this is irrelevant. We don't care about this foreign god stuff anymore. Now, you know, we've heard this too, right? It's something I rail about frequently. It's just Old Testament. It's all done away with. You know, we got Jesus now, says the Christians. Now, this is not a Christian teaching I'm referring to, but basically, all that still is old is irrelevant. Old Testament. Why do we care about it? And they asked the question, well, so how do we make this meaningful to us, you know, in our modern sensibilities? We have better gods now. Now, I say that sarcastically because it makes the point that I tend to want to make, which is, for crying out loud, how blind can we be? We don't have foreign gods. Aren't you paying attention? Haven't you flipped on the TV? Haven't you watched a Super Bowl game? Haven't you seen what's going on in Washington? Washington has more God than Carter had pills or than Bill Clinton has on the dead list. They got God upon God upon God. If you've been to Washington, D.C., look at all the statues of all the gods running around. Look at the great big arches. Look at all the pagan symbolism. Look at the phallus of George Washington, 666 feet tall, from the buried bottom to the tippy you-know-what. No foreign gods. Give me a break. This is, you know, it's almost obscene. I guess the point I want to try to make here is there are none so blind as those who will not see. The foreign gods are so literally ingrained in American society. We got American Idol. You name it. Maybe I'm out of touch. I don't know. Is American Idol still even on TV? I haven't watched network TV in several years. I don't even know. But anyway, somebody can tell me. Regardless, though, we still got a whole bunch of foreign gods. And, of course, if you've been to a Romanized pagan popish church of late, they got Mary worship. They got bunnies and eggs. They got all kinds of stuff that is pagan to the core. But it's not just that. And, by the way, we're going to talk about some of those pagan things in the next chapter, too. We'll see the real contrast. And I wouldn't expect necessarily an Orthodox Jewish site to be as critical as I intend to be of the Romanized gods. But I think the real issue here is just the general blindness. And sometimes it astounds me because I tend to forget this. I guess we need to be reminded periodically. Avodah Zarah. Foreign gods. As if they aren't still out there. Now, you know, you can ask questions, you know, how many babies and baby parts are being sacrificed, but that's just a part of it. It's a bad, nasty part. And yeah, flavor enhancers and all kinds of nasty things that are done with it, but that's how deep the devotion to Molech goes. I will often point out, for crying out loud, there's one litmus test. Everybody that's watched TV, seen the debates about the Supreme Court nominees whenever they happen, knows that there's one litmus test for the black robe priests of another god that decide what the clear words of the Constitution no longer mean. Right? These nine Roman priests, they put on their black robes and they say, well, what are we going to change about that document we don't like today? And the one litmus test, if you want to be one of those fake priests, is you have to know that abortion is a sacrament. They'll get asked, how do you feel about abortion? Well, it's a woman's right. Murder is just perfectly okay. And we don't even consider that, you know, Molech was a piker compared to the sacrament that is ensconced in the very choice that's a necessary condition for a Supreme Court judge, so far as the other gods in Washington are concerned today. So the foreign gods, no, give me a break. They go way, way deep. And as we go through the next chapter, hopefully that will be clear. But what also caught my eye is the contrast, right? You're going to destroy, utterly dash in pieces, hew down, burn, demolish, exterminate all of this stuff associated with these fake gods. And then you're going to put, basically my altar and my tabernacle at some point in the future in the place where Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says he will put his name. Not in all these places, on top of the green, the top of the hills, and under every asherim, and all that kind of stuff. In other words, just about anywhere where there was any place, there was paganism going on. Nope, it's going to be a particular place in his case. And that's enough of a distinction to kind of help us get our hands around it. But here's this one, too. And it says here, and at that point, you will rejoice. Semach. Rejoice. Be joyful. And that word, folks, appears over and over and over and over again throughout the rest of this portion. Matter of fact, it's a key element of Sukkot, the fall feast that's coming up, the climax of the fall feast, the week of dwelling in booths to remember that we were delivered from bondage. It's all about rejoicing. It's a joyous time. And I don't know. I sometimes have trouble with that. We get focused on all the things that are going wrong in the world and all the nastiness and, yep, challenges ahead. And maybe we lose track of the fact that the real essence of this, and it's interesting that it appears in the very same, literally, chapter within the same portion where we're going to destroy, break down, burn down, utterly smash to smithereen all of these fake gods. Go to the particular place that he puts his name and rejoice, rejoice, rejoice. Because of all the good stuff he does and all the things we put our hands to. And further it says, a little bit more on this idea of rejoicing. If the place that he puts his name is a little too far away from you, now it's for most of us in America and even in Europe, it is a long ways away. Well, then you can kill some of your herd, of your flock, that he has given to you anyway, as I've commanded you, and you can eat there. And he further, in a little while, is going to provide us with an option and basically says you can also convert it into kesef, into silver, into money. And then you can travel in these three feasts of ascension when you're supposed to go to Jerusalem, if you can, and then buy stuff back. You can buy anything you want and have a grand old party. Okay, we get a couple of other reminders. We've seen this before. I'll go through them briefly, but I do like to go through on Erev Shabbat, Friday night, through the portion pretty well in order, so we get a feel for the way he chose to lay it out. Then on Saturdays, a lot of times I'll change things around and go into this direction or that. But just as the gazelle in the heart is eaten, you eat. People who are both clean and unclean, in other words, those that aren't ritually clean, they can eat too. Only do not eat the blood. The blood contains the life. Do not eat the life with the flesh. Don't eat it. Instead, you pour out the blood on the earth as water. And don't eat it so that it'll go well with you and your children after you. Do that which is right in the eyes of Yahuwah. So, you take these holy things that you have, your vows, and you go to the place that Yahuwah shall choose, and you offer your burnt offerings, your flesh, and your blood upon the altar of Yahuwah. And then you can eat the flesh. Observe, he says, there's that word shamar, all of these words which I command you so it can go well with you and your children with you forever, while you do that which is good and right in the eyes of Yahuwah. When he cuts off these nations before you and you dispossess them, take heed, though, yet another reminder, take heed that you are not ensnared to go after them, even after they're destroyed from before you. And for crying out loud, don't ask questions like the following. How is it that these nations used to serve their gods? Oh, how clever. Let's take the little bunnies and eggs. Let's do all of the wonderful things. Let's talk about Lent and 40 days of fasting for Tammuz and the boar. And all. Let's not do any of that crap, that abomination, that stench in his nostrils, that stuff that he says over and over and over that he hates. How did these nations used to worship and serve their gods? Hey, maybe we should do likewise. Answer, no. And guess what? That's exactly what they did. Verse 31, though, summarizes it. Last verse in chapter 12. You will not do, thou shalt not do so unto Yahuwah Eloheka, for every abomination to Yahuwah, which he hates, they have done. for their gods. Even their sons and their daughters, they burn in the fire to their gods. And I say it again, doesn't that sound familiar? Literally, every abomination that you can imagine, you don't have to imagine it. All you got to do is just pick up most of the doctrinal guides that are so-called Christian and pagan and all kinds of other things that are running around in America. You'll see them all out there. You don't have to ask how do they worship their gods. You can flip on a TV and you can see it. Every abomination which he hates, they not only have done, they're doing it again. And it's literally hard to get away from. It's part of the reason why I think come out of her is the order of the day. At the end of this chapter, now this one's interesting because in the Hebrew Bibles, it's verse 1 of chapter 13. In the most English Bibles, it's the end of chapter 12. So I will usually quote it as Deuteronomy 12:32. But in the Hebrew version I'm looking at right now, there is no 12:32. There's 13:1. All right? Same verse, though. It says, everything in here, all the word which I command you, you shall observe to do. Do not add to it. Do not diminish from it. Some renderings say, don't add to, don't subtract from, but you get the point. I wrote it, don't change it. And yet, when I look at the two houses and talk about this frequently, Orthodox Judaism, Pharisaism, as opposed to Romanized, paganized, universal, Catholic, so-called Christianity, we've got two different camps, two different wives, two different kingdoms, two different houses that have literally made their bones for centuries by doing precisely those two things, adding to, subtracting from. They'll take away the things he says to keep forever. They say it's old, it's done away with, don't do it. And then you turn around, you've got the Pharisees that say, oh, it's not enough to keep Sabbath. He's given us, oh, maybe 10 or so rules for how to do that. No, we need about 1,700 odd more burdens that'll basically stifle you. How far can you walk on the Sabbath? How many stones can you pick up? What can you carry? What can't you carry? Read what he says. And then remember he says this, not once, but twice. He said it in chapter 4, too. Don't add to it. Don't subtract from what I have written for you. And furthermore, if you want to turn to the very end of the book, I think it's interesting that the last commandment in Scripture in the book of Revelation is essentially the same thing. If you do add to or subtract from, you're going to see your portion in the book of life added to or subtracted from. All right, all of that sets up chapter 13. And this one is interesting. I will go through it. But I want to basically make this point first. You talk to most Orthodox Jews, those that know Torah. I gotta put it that way. You talk to most Jews that say, I don't accept Jesus as the Messiah. And there'll be a number of reasons, but I can guarantee you that almost the first one off of most of their mouths, if they actually understand the Torah, will be this chapter, Deuteronomy chapter 13. Why? Because what it says here is, if there arises in the midst of you a so-called prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, oh hey, even if it comes to pass, but he tells you to go after pagan gods and serve other so-called mighty ones, which you've not known, don't listen to him. Don't hearken to him. And it gets worse. He gives some very specific things that you're supposed to do to that so-called prophet or dreamer of dreams. And it doesn't matter, even if the things he speaks of come to pass. Well, they say, if Jesus says the law is done away with, right here he fails the test. He cannot be the so-called Messiah, the prophet, like unto Moshe. And you know what? They're absolutely, positively, no question about it, right. If Jesus did away with the law, he is a false prophet, deserving of death, not at all the one that was spoken of by Scripture. Here is a disconnect the likes of which, well, can divide houses. The point, of course, is, if you read, and this is part of the reason why you'll often hear me be very specific, distinguishing between another Jesus whom we've not preached, as Paul writes, beware, I was afraid, he says, that you might very well buy into that particular lie. Well, folks, the very first words out of Yahushua's mouth in the so-called Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, I am not here to change not the tiniest little bit of the Torah. the instruction. Not one yod or tittle. So long as heaven and earth still exist. Right there, we got a major disconnect. Did he or did he not do away with the law? Answer, what do you mean when you say law? Do you mean the crap the Pharisees are talking about? All the additions and subtractions? Do you mean the crap that the Pope says? His additions? Oh, we're changing the Sabbath to Sun God Day, and pork is just fine. Chow down on a pork sandwich, but no fish on, well, whatever the heck it is today. No meat on Fridays. Where does this stuff come from? Adding and subtracting. No wonder there's so much of a mess out there, and the houses are divided. Because people do not read what he says, and he says it here. Keep my commandments. Don't add all this pagan crap in. Well, the Roman church has literally, for 1700 plus years, said, oh, well, we'll take all this pagan crap, and we'll Christianize it. I saw one. You've probably seen these things. People have them hanging on their walls. A little sand dollar showing all the wonderful Christian symbolism in the sand dollar. Well, I'm sure God created it for a reason. But the pagan stuff that they keep pointing to in there is not, got nothing to do with the birthday of Mithras on December 25th, and so forth and so on. This is clear. This is unequivocal. This has not changed. He is, in fact, the same yesterday and today and tomorrow. But as we go through chapter 13 here, you have to admit, no wonder there's a divide. And this is one of those things that people that basically keep Sun God Day and Xmas Day and Ishtar Sun God services and Lent and all this other abominable crap that he says he hates. No wonder they say the Old Testament is done away with. Because if they were ever to read this, they'd say, we got a problem. Serving another Jesus whom we've not preached, because no wonder. No wonder people that read this stuff reject another Jesus, as Paul rightly said, whom we have not preached. So let's go through chapter 13, and I think you'll see it real clearly. If there arises in the midst of you a prophet, a dreamer of dreams, any old prophet, not just the one that they're going to call the Mashiach, but you'd think if it applies to any old prophet, from Ezekiel to Daniel to Isaiah, well, then it ought to apply to the Torah made flesh. I mean, after all, if the Torah made flesh doesn't know what he wrote, then who does? So a prophet does something. He gives you a sign or a wonder, and looky here, comes to pass. But then he says the immortal and fatal words, let's go serve some other gods. Ha, ha, ha. Let's go with Molech. Let's go with Beelzebub. Let's go with any of a bunch of them. Let's go with Ishtar, Sun God Day. You know, the goddess, equal to the god. Mother Earth. We got all kinds of them. Let's go after them. Don't listen. For crying out loud, don't hearken, says verse 4. For Yahuwah is testing you. He is seeing whether or not you can read. He's seeing whether or not you love him with all your heart and with all your soul. Isn't it funny? People that tell you, oh, I love him, and I'm willing to do all this stuff that he calls abomination and ignore what he wrote. You fail the test right there. No wonder Jews don't come to Jesus if they know Torah. Now, they can come to Yahushua if they understand what he really said as opposed to what he was supposed to have said if he was as smart as the popes and priests and TV preachers. After this, after Yahuwah your Elohecha shall you walk, and him you shall fear, his commandments you shall keep. No, what? Not the popes? Not the TV evangelist preachers? Not the Pharisees even? Not the ones that are added to and subtracted from? His commandments you shall keep, the ones that are right here in genuine print. His voice you shall hearken to, him you shall serve, and unto him you shall cleave. And that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death. Because he has spoken perversion against Yahuwah Elohecha, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, redeemed you from the house of bondage, to draw you aside. He's trying to get you to walk in a whole different way than you were commanded. He's trying to turn you into a good Catholic, or a good Orthodox, or whatever, some other 501c3 denomination in the United States. Anything, in other words, except what is written. Yahuwah alone you shall serve. He is trying to draw you back into bondage. So, this is how it says, you shall put away the evil. Hurrah! From the midst of you. And look, he says in verse 7, I don't care if it's your brother, or your son, or your daughter, or the wife of your bosom, or your friend that's like your own soul. If they come to you secretly and say, hey, let's go and serve other gods, which you've not known, not you or your fathers. You know, the gods of all of these people around you. From one end to the other to the earth. Doesn't matter. Don't consent to him. Don't hearken. Don't obey. Neither shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare, nor shall you conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Your hand will be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. Stone him with stones that he die, because he has sought to draw you away from Yahuwah Eloheka, who brought you out of bondage, out of the house of bondage, and all Israel, Kol Israel, shall hear and fear, and don't do that wickedness anymore. Put it away. Now, whoa, folks, you read something like that nowadays? How dare that mere God of the Bible write something like this? No wonder the Romanized, paganized church that does all of this stuff doesn't want to hear this. We're better than that. Now we got our pagan gods. Can't we just all get along here? Yeah, bring them all in. Now we're not in the land anymore. Hey, guess why? Because we were kicked out for cause, for doing this kind of crap that he says he hates. So arguably, and this is where I suggest we need to read and be careful. Arguably, the moral of the story today is come out of her. Separate ourselves. We got kicked out. We didn't do this. We failed this test. Now we're immersed up to our elbows, no, past our eyebrows in the paganism. So the moral of the story is, touch not the unclean thing. Come out of her. Don't participate in the sin so that you don't partake of the plagues. He'll clean it up. Our job is to blow the shofar, recognize that there is a sword coming upon the land, and be somewhere else, physically, spiritually, economically, in every way we can. Now, if you hear tell concerning your cities that Yahuwah has given you to dwell in, remember, we're not there anymore. Certain sons of Belial are gone out from the midst of you, and they've drawn away the inhabitants of their city, saying, let's go serve other gods, which you've not known. Well, you're supposed to inquire, make a diligent search, and if it's true, and it's certain, that this abomination is being wrought in the midst of you, then smite the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, destroying it utterly, and everything in it. Gather the spoil and burn it, and it shall not be even built again. Well, at least in most of the world that didn't happen. Interestingly, Rome, of course, is not in the land. I guess that's all I'll say about that. You're not to cleave to anything that is devoted. In other words, devoted to another Elohim, literally satanically devoted, if you will, so that Yahuwah may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show you mercy and have compassion on you, just as he sworn to your fathers. So the chapter ends this way, after a lot of stuff that is politically incorrect and downright shocking to people that have been engaged in this kind of thing for longer than most of them have ever even considered possible, because we've inherited lies from our fathers. At least, my suggestion is this. When we begin to read these things and try to put them into context and understand them, and even when I look at the teachings that I started off with about how, oh, this stuff about foreign gods, it doesn't sit well with us. What could it have been so attractive for people back then? This is why it's irrelevant. For crying out loud. I think part of that is literally a reluctance on the part of some teachers to call it like it is and to just come right out and say it. You know what? There's a whole hell of a lot of paganism in this world, and it's immersed. The world is immersed in this crap, these abominations. Crap is a really kind word compared to the way the Hebrew ought to understand, at least we ought to understand that Hebrew word abomination. These are detestable things. That's why he says destroy them, burn them, tear them down, utterly erase their names. And we didn't. And now we're literally wallowing in it. It's pig filth. And it's so pervasive that people think it's irrelevant. It's kind of like asking a fish about water, right? The fish doesn't understand that he lives in the water. Well, we live in this crap. No wonder we think, oh, well, we don't have pagan foreign gods anymore. No. We don't have much that's not. Our very language is filled with this stuff. Do that which is right, concludes the chapter. Keep all of his commandments and do that which is right in the eyes of Yahuwah. Chapter 14 says, you are the children of Yahuwah. You're not to cut yourselves, nor make any baldness between your eyes for the dead. You're a set apart people to Yahuwah. He's chosen you to be his own. Don't eat any abominable thing. We get a reprise here of things that we've already seen. What is food and what is not food? And we'll do this quickly. Here are the things you can eat. The ox, the sheep, the goat, the hart, the gazelle, basically elk and deer and antelope and little hopping things that have a cloven hoof and that chew the cud. They have multiple stomachs is another way to put it. But they chew the cud and they have a split hoof. And we get a number of examples. Primary example of something that has a split hoof but does not chew the cud. The cud. Deceptive, little son of a gun. The swine, the pig. He looks kosher, but he ain't. He looks like food, but he isn't. He is, in fact, put on earth to eat dead things and to begin the process of cleaning up death and recycling it up through the food chain. So, when it comes to animals, what is food? Food has a split hoof and chews the cud. Anything else? Not food. How about things that are swimming in the waters? Well, it has fins and scales. Key word in both these places is and. Then it's food. You can eat it. If it has fins but no scales or vice versa, nope, not food. It's unclean. Don't eat it. Birds are a little bit more difficult. Now, I'm going to do something here which I'm careful about, and that is a little bit of markology. In other words, basically, what Scripture really gives you is a list of things. It says, here are birds that are not food. Do not eat them. The vulture, the osprey, the falcon, the kite, the raven, ostriches, interestingly, owls, pelicans, carrion vultures, cormorants, storks, herons. A lot of these are pretty clearly either carrion birds or, what's the other word I'm looking for? Predators. They eat meat. Ostriches will eat almost anything. They're not food because, kind of like pigs, they eat dead stuff. They begin the process. Now, that's the markology. In other words, me trying to explain what the list has in common. So I'm not proposing that we don't look at the list when it comes to birds and say, okay, is a chicken okay? Yeah, it seems to be. Other birds, okay. But not any of these carrion birds or birds of prey. Don't eat them. And if you're in doubt, look at the list and see if it's on the list. All the things that are winged, that are clean, you can eat. By the way, don't eat roadkill. Well, that's a polite way to put it. No, it's really things that die of themselves, diseased animals you find out in the field. You can give it to the stranger. He'll eat it. Mikey likes it. But don't eat it yourself. And then it says this, don't see the kid in its mother's milk. What the heck does that mean? Well, some say that means you need to have separate refrigerators and food in your kitchen. Separate the milk and the meat. Don't have a cheeseburger and so forth. This is the kashrut. This is the rabbinic interpretation. For those that say that's what it must be and this is how that verse must be interpreted, all right, fine. I'm not going to argue with you, but I'll admit it. I don't see it. I don't get it. And I'm not sure that that's correct. However, if you're curious as to where this separation of milk and meat in a kosher kitchen comes from, that is at least the verse that they'll usually point to. Tithe of your increase, eat in the places where he has put his name. And here's the place where I referenced a bit of go. If you need to go, but it's a long ways away and you can't carry it, but when you do go there, you can literally sell your food for money. Kesef, silver, you can put that money in your hand, bind it up, go to the place where he chooses, and then you can take that money, that silver, and you can buy anything it says your soul desires. Sheep, oxen, wine, strong drink. What? Aren't the Baptists right here? No, this says the Baptists are wrong. It says you can buy wine or strong drink, anything your soul wants, and eat it before Yahuwah. And furthermore, can you dance? It says you can rejoice, and you ought to. You're supposed to rejoice, you and your household. Don't forget the Levite. He doesn't have any portion or inheritance with you either. Oh, and at the end of every 3 years, you bring forth the tithe of your increase, lay it up in your gates, and that's for the Levite because he has no inheritance. And the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, they all come. They get to eat and are satisfied. And Yahuwah may, in fact, bless you in all the work of your hand, which you do. A lot of interesting stuff in here. Again, this, by the way, is a pretty long Torah portion, and we're already, a little bit late this evening because we got a late start. So I'm going to summarize some of the next a little bit more briefly. We have seen it. Yes, it is important, and no, it hasn't been done away with. And yes, because this also has to do with slavery, I think it's more than coincidental that it appears right here. At the end of every 7 years, right, you make a release. Here's how you do it. Creditors release the things that they have lent unto their neighbors. Do not exact it of his neighbor and his brother, because the release of Yahuwah has been proclaimed every 7 years, the sabbatical year. A foreigner, okay, you can exact it from them. But if it's from your brother, you release it from your hand. And when it comes to the needy, bless them. They'll always be with you, we're told elsewhere in Scripture, but we do make provisions for them. And furthermore, if only you will diligently hearken to the voice of Yahuwah to observe, to do all of this commandment, he will bless you, just as he has promised you. You will lend to many nations, not borrow, rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. If there is someone needy among you, one of your brethren within your gates and the land, do not harden your heart, but surely you'll give to your brother. Open your hand to him. Lend him what he needs. And don't let there be a base thought in your heart. Basically what this says is, look, we're getting pretty close to this year of release. If I lend to him and the seventh year comes, well, I'm out, man. On the other hand, if there's 6.5 years to go, well, maybe I'll lend to him. He's got plenty of time to pay me back. Don't be doing that upfront machinations is kind of what this says. It's the seventh year. The year of release is at hand. Don't be saying that to yourself, and let your eye be evil against your needy brother so that you use that as an excuse to give him nothing. And he cries out against you to Yahuwah, because this would be sin in you. Give to him. Don't let your heart be grieved when you give to him, because this is the thing that Yahuwah will bless you in all your work, all that you put your hand to. The poor will never cease out of the land. We talked about that, and so does Yeshua. So I command you, open your hand unto the poor and your needy brother in the land. Now, we have another God today, the God of the Almighty State, that says, oh, I gave it the office. We will tax you. We know better than you who your brother is. These are all these people that we're bringing into the land that are going to overrun your gates. No, no, folks. It's another one of those fake gods. They don't serve the God of the Bible anyway. So let's be clear about who our brothers are and who the real Elohim is and who the fakes are and all the fake and foreign and other gods that are no longer irrelevant. They're just evil, and they're taken over. It is us individually who should be giving to the poor and doing some of these things, not allowing the Almighty State to say, oh, well, we are the only ones that know that. We're the redistributionists here. If your brother, a Hebrew or Hebrew-S, is sold, he's to serve 6 years. Seventh year, he goes out free. Now, here is another reprise. We see this in Deuteronomy here and also in Exodus chapter 21, right after the giving of the Ten Commandments. When he goes out, you don't send him out empty-handed. He has served you. So give to him liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, your wine press. Of all the things you've been blessed with and the years he's served you, give to him. Remember, you were once a bondman in Mitzrayim. So therefore, I command you to do this thing. And furthermore, if he says the following, I won't go out. Hey, I've been here for quite a while. I'm liking this house. It's okay. Because he loves you and your house and he's fared well with you. Then it gives you the procedure. Again, this is another repeat from Exodus 21. Take an awl, bore it through his ear into the doorpost of the house. Can you imagine there's a little bit of blood left on the doorpost? Interesting. And he shall be your bondman forever, at least up until the Jubilee is usually how that is read, but admittedly it says ha'olam. Your bondwoman, same thing if she wants to stay. Now, at this point I pause, because there is an interesting bit of midrash that I usually mention when we talk about this kind of thing, and it goes something like this. The understanding is, we tend to say, oh, well, you know, a good master, the slaves want to stay. And I can understand that. That seems logical to us. But you know what? The truth of the matter is, the way that the history plays out, as I have had it related, and I tend to think this is at least worth listening to and understanding, The good master teaches the slave how to be a free man. And at the end of the 6 years, he says, thank you. Thank you for your service. And the slave says, no, thank you for teaching me Torah. Thank you for teaching me how to be a productive free man. And you part, and you give him all of this good stuff, and you bless him liberally, and everybody is blessed, and he goes out, and now you have a friend, not a slave, not a bond servant. On the other hand, if he wants to stay, basically, somebody has failed, is how the story goes. Somebody has failed to really teach the slave man or slave woman what it is that they ought to be doing instead of just being a slave, or a bond servant. And there's a message there. All right, firstling males of your herd, those belong to Yahuwah. Don't work them. You are literally there. They are to be sacrificed to Yahuwah in the place that He chooses. Don't sacrifice the ones that are blemished or lame or blind or whatever. Eat it within your gates. The gazelle, the hart, and the clean and the unclean alike all may eat these things. Just remember, don't eat the blood. As always, poured on the ground as water. Chapter 16 gives us another reprieve of things that have also, says the paganized church, all been done away with. Don't have to do this anymore because now we have Sun God Day and Christmas and Ishtar Sun Day and all this other stuff so much better than these feasts that Yahuwah says observe, keep, and do. So let's capsule synopsis. Observe the month of Abib. That's the month of the Passover. You're to keep it. That's the month that he brought you out of Egypt by night. Don't eat leavened bread. 7 days you eat unleavened bread. It's the bread of affliction. There's to be no leaven in your house. Nor shall you eat the flesh, of the offering or of the food there. Don't let it remain till morning. Do this sacrifice in the place where Yahuwah puts his name. Seventh day, first day, solemn assembly unto Yahuwah, do no work. From there, you count 7 times 7 plus 1, and that is the time when the standing corn is numbered and ready, and it's called the Feast of Weeks. You keep that, Shavuot, unto Yahuwah, as the measure of your free will offering. And you are again to rejoice before Yahuwah, you, your son, your daughter, your maidservant, all those within your gates in this place that he's caused his name to dwell. Remember, you were a bondservant. Do these things. And then we get around to the Feast of Tabernacles too, Sukkot, the one that's coming up soon. Keep that feast 7 days after you've gathered in the increase of your harvest from your threshing floor and your wine press, and again, rejoice. In this feast, you, your son, your daughter, your maidservant, your manservant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, everybody that's within your gates. 7 days you keep this feast to Yahuwah in a place that he shall choose. And he will again bless you in all your increase and the work of your hands, and you shall be altogether, there's this word again, joyful. Summary is that there's 3 of these so-called Feasts of Ascension, 3 times in the year that all the males are to appear before Yahuwah in the place that he, at this point, was going to choose, and now we look back in hindsight, did choose. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, often it's slightly different, but it's at the time, basically, that we refer to as Passover season. The Feast of Weeks, 50 days following that season. This is the last of the spring feasts. Shavuot. And then finally, I think I misspoke. Anyway, Feast of Unleavened Bread, Feast of Weeks, Feast of Tabernacles, the 3 Feasts of Ascension. Do not appear before Yahuwah empty-handed. Now that is key and interesting. Do not appear before him empty-handed. You're to bring food, wine, victuals, every man as he is able, according to the blessing that he has been given. And guess what? As a friend of mine likes to say, it's a great big party. Rejoice before Yahuwah. And that's a pretty wonderful way to end the portion. No foreign gods. Let's remember, we were bond servants. There's a little bit of everything in this portion. How to be free. How it is that people who are in debt are to be released and treated after their debts are discharged. how it is that he's going to make a different place, different from the things and places and means by which foreign gods are worshipped. And we're going to rejoice in the fact that that difference is really, really important.